Okay, so this is standard model and beyond number 25. I'm beginning to see the end closing in on me, and I'm realizing it's going to be a little bit of a blitz, but it's going to be a little bit fast. But I'll try to make everything clear, and of course, speak up if anything is not. So one thing I was thinking as we approach the end is that I'm going to be able to give the gist of the story, but if you're interested in more, you know, if you're interested in any of these topics, I was going to give some references where you can read more. I was hoping to have my own paper about this done by this point, but I'm still working on everything. So that didn't happen. So I can't give you that yet, but there are several excellent papers that I would like to recommend, and I figure why wait till the end? Maybe I should just do it sooner rather than later. So let me just start with that before we get back to the magic square and the standard model. So first is that for the part of the course about grand unification, well, grand unification has sort of a part that works well and a part that doesn't work well. The part that works well is how it cleans up the story about where the fermions come from, and the part that doesn't work well is about the bosons. So for a great discussion of the part that works well, and in particular of SO10 and SU5 and Patty Salam, and how they all fit together, for that, I recommend this article. I don't know if I mentioned this already in my lectures on grand unification, but let me just mention it again just in case. Great article by Baez and Huerta called The Algebra of Grand Unified Theories, and that is archive 09041556. Now, about this whole story about understanding the various exceptional objects in mathematics as having some kind of unified origin related to the Octonians, and the geometrical meaning of all these things. So there's a classic paper from the 60s by Hans Freudenthal, who was one of the sort of pioneered this field, called Lie Groups and the Foundations of Geometry. And is a really very, very good readable paper. Okay, so that's 1964. There's another terrific, more modern exposition of the same circle of ideas by John Baez, which is just called The Octonians. So that is archive 01055. And then about the magic square and triality, which we'll get to triality today, the paper where there's a kind of unpublished, but you can find it on the web, set of lecture notes by Pierre Ramon from 1976, called Introduction to Lie Groups. And if you can't find it, let me know and I can just email it to you. To Exceptional Lie Groups and Lie Algebras. That's from 1976, and that's the paper where he introduces the idea for how to express the magic square in terms of triality. And then there's a the more again there's a more modern kind of more formal and full treatment of the magic square. If you want, the kind of current Bible for the magic square is by Barton and Sudbury. And that paper is called, well, I won't write the title. It's called Magic Squares and Matrix Models of Lie Algebras, but I'll give you the archive number. That's archive math/02-03-010. And finally, the observation about the relation of all of this to the standard model that to me is the seems like the most striking observation that's been made about this connection is in a series of papers by Michel Dubois-Violette and Ivan Kudrov. Sometimes alone, sometimes it's just by one of those authors, sometimes by both. But if I was going to recommend the one paper that to me is the has the kind of key result that works, it's this paper, Exceptional Quantum Geometry and Particle Physics 2, and that's archive 1808-08-110. Okay, so those are, I believe this is a very fascinating topic. If I've managed to convince any of you of that and you want to look any more into it, those are the papers I recommend. Okay. Great. Okay, so last time we finished presenting one version of the magic square, but I'm going to want another one also. So let me try to briefly explain that. That one is Ramon's version based on triality. So let's say what triality is about. Okay, so here, you know, what happened was that in 1925, Cartan noticed that SO8, so SO8 the Dynkin diagram for SO8 has more symmetry than other Dynkin diagrams. We haven't talked about Dynkin diagrams in this course, but this is just a brief word of motivation. So it has this extra symmetry that it has a sort of threefold rotational symmetry. And so he noticed that as a consequence of that, there are three representations of SO8 that which are for most groups SON are different. So there's the vector representation. So SO8, 8x8 matrices can act on an 8-component vector. But then there's also the, as with any even dimensional SON group, there's the left-handed chiral spinner and the right-handed chiral spinner. Now, you know, in four dimensions, the left and right-handed chiral spinners are each 2-component spinners. But as you go up in dimension, every time you go up by 2 to the next even dimension, the size of the chiral spinner doubles. So in 6 dimensions, it's a 4-component thing, and 8 dimensions, it's an 8-component thing. So these are all 8-component vectors, and basically, they're actually all these three representation spaces are actually isomorphic to each other. And so, if we take an element of G1 in the group SO8, well, it's represented maybe by itself on the vector representation, but there's some other 8x8 matrix that represents its action on the left-handed spinner, and some other third matrix which represents its action by on the right-handed spinner. And so as a consequence, okay, but G2 and G3 are other elements of other 8x8 elements of SO8. So there's this sense in which any element of SO8 is is collected into a triple with two associated elements. So G1, G2, and G3. If you tell me any one of those, the other two turn out to be uniquely determined. And if I had instead taken G2 as my original element here and represented, well, I'd get the same three elements G1, G2, G3 on the side, but just permuted. So that's that. There's this triality phenomenon that happens in SO8, and it turns out that the norm division algebras inherit this property. Of course, the biggest, basically because the biggest one, the Octonians, is eight dimensional. And so for any norm division algebra K, there is a corresponding so-called triality algebra, tri-K, which is defined as follows. So first, remember what the derivation algebra of K means. Okay, so it's some sort of it's the Lie algebra that generates the automorphisms. And so these are the elements of this algebra are maps D from K to K. These are matrices that map K into itself, and that satisfy this Leibniz rule that D of XY is equal to D of X times Y plus X times D of Y. Okay, so triality, tri-K, the triality algebra is similar, except instead of taking the same operator D at every spot in this Leibniz rule, we let them be three different operators. Okay, so we look at an equation like this, A of XY is equal to B of X times Y plus X times C of Y. Okay, so it's some generalization of the Leibniz rule. We're looking for now a triplet of three operators, A, B, and C, such that, so just like for the Leibniz rule, we wanted an operator D that satisfied this equation for any elements X and Y in our norm division algebra. Now, here we're looking in the triality algebra, we're looking for a triple of objects, A, B, and C, that satisfy this equation, again, for any X and Y in our norm division algebra. Okay, so the triality of K is some generalization of the derivations, and it includes the derivations as a sub-algebra. I mean, in particular, if we took D, D, and D as our triple, that would be an example of a triple in tri-K. But of course, that's nothing but the derivation D. And let me explain what I mean by saying that this thing is an algebra. What does it mean to have an algebra made from these triples? Well, you can check, it's easy to check that if you have two triples, A, B, C, and A prime, B prime, C prime, that satisfy the above equations, the above triality condition, then their sum does too, in the sense that if you now look at the triple A plus A prime, B plus B prime, and C plus C prime, that also satisfies the triality condition. And then also if you look at the commutator, so you consider the triple A commutator A prime, comma, B commutator B prime, comma, C commutator C prime. Okay, that you can check that also satisfies the triality condition. So these triples do form a Lie algebra, and it's a Lie algebra that contains derivations of K as a subalgebra. And so in particular, let's make a little table here. So if these are our norm division algebras K, so we have R, let me make it a little bit bigger.
Excuse me, just a quick question, if you don't mind.
Yes, go for it.
Yeah, does the placement of the A and B's matter? Do we want that always a of the product has the Leibniz rules, or we wish
it, it has a symmetry. It turns out to have a symmetry very analogous to the case of SO8. So if A, B, and C satisfy this equation, then
You can switch the positions.
I should have checked this exactly, but it's, I want to say it's almost that then the cyclic permutation BCA and CAB also satisfy it. And that might be right, but there might be also something where we have to take the conjugate of some of them when we cyclically permute like that. But it's like that. It's like basically there's if any triplet works, then there's also the cyclic permutations of that triplet that also work. Possibly with, so I'll get back. I didn't go back and check that, but it's something like that. So let's make our table here so I'll just tell you what the, so here we have, so first of all, if on the second line, let me remind you what dir of k is. It's zero for the real numbers, zero for the complex numbers, SU2, for the quaternions, and G2 for the octonions. Whereas the triality algebra of K is, it's again zero for the real numbers. For the complex numbers, it's S. It's SO2 squared. So it's SO2 direct summed with another copy of itself. For H, it turns out to be SU2 cubed. So SU2 plus SU direct sum with SU2 direct sum with SU2. And then for O, it turns out to be SO8, okay? So which reflects the fact that all of this triality business is ultimately coming from SO8. So in other words, this is a 14-dimensional algebra. SO8 is a 28-dimensional algebra. So it's a kind of a generalization of the notion, it's kind of generalization of the Leibniz rule, which is available to you, if you want, kind of almost like a generalization of calculus that is available when you're working with a norm division algebra, and in particular, really kind of only reveals itself fully with the octonions. So in the case of the octonions, you know, once I choose any element B, A here, for any element A in SO8, there's a unique element B and C which accompany it, for which this equation is satisfied. So any element A is associated with a unique triple, which is corresponding to this triple in SO8. And then there's this permutation property that I was just mentioning, where if you have one triple, then its permutations are also in the algebra. Okay, so what does this all have to do with the magic square? Well, so last time, what we had explained was that for any pair, the magic square is that for any pair of norm division algebras, Ka and Kb, we can define an associated Lie algebra, which we said had three components. The first, as a vector space, it was the direct sum of three components, the derivations of Ka, plus the derivations of KB, and then plus the space of 3x3 traceless matrices, which are anti-Hermitian and whose elements are in KA tensor KB. Okay, and so that's what it is a vector space. And then to turn that into a Lie algebra, we specified last time the commutators. If we took, you know, an element of any two components of these, two of these three components, and took the commutator with one another. Okay, so what Ramon points out is that there's another way to write this Lie algebra, which is as tri of Ka plus the triality algebra of Kb, and then plus three copies of Ka tensor Kb. So we have Ka tensor Kb, and then plus another copy of Ka tensor Kb, and plus a third copy of Ka tensor Kb. Okay, so let's first just do a quick check that the dimensions work out right. Okay, so let me, so I remind you that I had drawn this magic square yesterday, and we put R, C, H, and O, R, C, H, and O as our four norm division algebras. So this is Ka, a table of Ka and Kb. And for each combination, for each entry in this table, this constructs, the magic square constructs a Lie algebra. And in particular, the most interesting ones here are on the, involve the octonions, where we got F4, E6, E7, E8. Okay. And so we counted one as an example to make sure we could make sure the dimensions at least were working out. So we checked yesterday E7, so let's try that again. So what would we get from this formula for Ramon's formula for the dimension of E7? We're supposed to get 133, I remind you. So let's see, the triality out, so E7 corresponds to the case where tri A is H and Ka is H and Kb. So we're looking at the case H tensor O. And so from here, the first component, triality algebra of H, well, we said that's SU3 plus SU3 plus SU3, SU2 plus SU2 plus SU2. SU2 is three dimensional. So we have three copies of it. So that's a nine-dimensional algebra. Then we have the triality algebra of O. We said that's SO8. Well, so SO8, remember, has dimension, SON has dimension n times n minus 1 over 2. So for SO8, it would be 8 times 7 over 2, which is 28. And then finally, H tensor O, well, H is four dimensional, O is eight dimensional, so that's a 32 dimensional space, and then times three, because we have three copies of it here. So let's see, does that work? So 32, so that's 96 plus 28 is 114, 134, 96 plus 28. What did I do wrong here? Is that working out to 133 or no?
Oh, yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, sorry, I just can't add. Okay, great. I'll take your word for it. So there you go. That's that check. So now, so that I don't have to rewrite everything, I'm just going to erase this, if you don't mind. Okay, so the dimensions seem right. So what are the Lie brackets for this new Ramon formulation of things? So to explain that, to explain how this version works, so suppose that an element of this part of the triality algebra of Ka, we'll call that triple Ta. Okay, so that's a triple of elements, Ta1, TA2, TA3, and then for the triality algebra KB, that's an element TB, which is TB1, again, a triple of three operators, TB1, TB2, TB3. Okay, and then let's call these last three components, to distinguish them, let's call this KA tensor KB component one and component two and component three. And so let's say an element of that algebra, we'll call an element of the first algebra A tensor B, and we'll write a little subscript one next to it to remind ourselves that it belongs to the first of these vector spaces, whereas here we would call it A tensor B with a subscript two to remind us that it lives in that second vector space, and A tensor B sub three. Okay, how do they go? Well, for these first two components, so these form two commuting Lie subalgebras on their own. So the idea is that these are just, you know, tri of Ka is whatever Lie algebra it is according to the table on the previous slide, and same with triality of Kb. So those Lie algebras just have the Lie brackets that they have. That part of the vector space, if you take, you know, any two elements from this initial triality part of the vector space, they just have the Lie brackets that they have that they inherit from themselves, from their already Lie algebras. So what we need to do is figure out what happens when we take an element from here and take a bracket with one of the later three vector spaces, or what happens if we take a Lie bracket between two elements of from over here. Okay, so, well, it's very neat how it works, actually. So if we take an element from triality algebra A, triality of Ka, and we take its bracket with one of the, with an element from the ith Ka tensor Kb space, then what we get is a new guy, which is we take the ith operator from TA, from the triplet TA, we act on A, we don't do anything to B, and then we put that vector back, that vector gets mapped into the ith copy of Ka tensor Kb, if you see what I mean. So this is so TA acts when acting on a vector from here, from the first component of Ka tensor Kb, is a linear map from Ka tensor Kb1 to itself. And in particular, it's the first, in that case, it would be TA1, the first component of this triplet that does the mapping. And it only acts on A. Okay, so for TB, there's an analogous thing. So now if this acts, if this is commuted with a vector from the ith component of Ka tensor Kb, then it leaves A alone, but then TBI, the ith operator in the triplet of TB, acts on B. And again, we place that whole tensor product back into the ith copy of Ka tensor Kb. And now finally, what happens if we take how do we define the Lie bracket between a vector from the ith component of Ka tensor Kb and the jth component? Where I and j are not equal, what we get is we get a component, we get a, that gets mapped to the following, let's call these sorry, let's call this one to distinguish them. Let's call these A, the first guy A and B, and then the second one I'll call A prime tensor B prime. So then what we get is A prime conjugate times A conjugate tensored with B prime conjugate B conjugate. And we put that all back into the kth component. So where I, J, and K form, are in cyclic order. So if we take a component from A1 and component from A2, and we take their Lie bracket, if we take a component from the first bracketed with the component with an element from the second, we get an element in the third by this formula, for example. Okay. Great. So I know that's a little quick, but that's how the magic square works in the triality formulation. So now, without further ado, let me try to move on to the standard model and tell you about this Todorov and the thing that Todorov and Dubois-Violette pointed out about how the exceptional Jordan algebra relates to the standard model. Okay, so let's see. In short, what do I want to explain? Basically, I want to explain that. So we saw previously that that H3O, the exceptional Jordan algebra, the 3x3 Hermitian matrices with octonionic entries and with the product given by the anticommutator, that its automorphism group. Its automorphism, the Lie algebra of derivations was F4. Let me tell it to you in terms of the groups. So its automorphism group is F4. Now that has there what Todorov and Dubois-Violette point out is that there are two maximal subgroups of that. So, which I'll tell you about in a moment, but those are spin 9, and another one is SU3 times SU3 mod Z3. And what they point out is that if you take the intersection of those two groups, that turns out to be exactly the standard model gauge group, SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6, okay, including the sort of mod Z6 factor that we see showing up as the charge quantization, giving the fact that the charges in the standard model are quantized in multiples of 1/6. And so that's the basic observation they made. And then, but it the thing that makes it even more interesting is that first of all, they don't really mention this in their paper. There's a very natural interpretation of these two, geometric interpretation of these two subgroups, which makes this observation much more striking in terms of its relevance for, in terms of the likelihood that it's relevant for physics. There's a question of what it has to say about the fermions, and what it might explain about why the fermions behave the way they do, and why there's three generations, and how that might be related to triality. And so that's what we want to talk about. But so let's start by just explaining this first result by Todorov and Dubois-Violette. Okay, so to explain it, let's start with the octonions. Okay, so first, before we move on to the exceptional Jordan algebra, I just want to explain one thing about the octonions, which is that a sort of analogous fact about the octonions, which is that So the Octonians, in that case, the automorphism group was G2. But it has a subalgebra SU3 and a subgroup SU3. And so I want to explain that first. So let's say we take an arbitrary element of the Octonians, X. Okay, so we know we can write that as some 8-component vector with real coefficients. So we have A0 times the first basis vector 1 plus A1 times I plus A2 times J plus A3 times K plus A4 times L plus A5 times Li plus A6 times Lj plus A7 times Lk. Okay, but now we can rewrite that. We can pick one of these imaginaries as our favorite. Okay, let's pick L. And we can reinterpret that as the imaginary I, let's call it capital I, in the complex numbers. Okay, so let's pick that as our favorite guy and regroup, try to regroup this expression into complex and into so that the coefficients look like complex numbers instead. Okay, so we have A0. I'll group this guy and this guy together and write them as A0 plus A4L. Okay, and then I'll group this guy and this guy together, and I'll write that as A1 plus A5L, all times I. And then I'll group pair this guy and this guy together and write that as A2 plus A6L times J. And finally, I'll take my last pair, A3 and A7, I'll write that as A3 plus A7L times K. So, in other words, we've rewritten this now, instead of the original form, so instead of the original form where we wrote it as a sum of 8 basis vectors times real coefficients, now we've rewritten it in this form where we have, it's like M0 times 1 plus M1 times I plus M2 times J plus M3 times K, where now the coefficients M0, M1, M2, and M3 are complex numbers. Okay, and so we can, and let's furthermore write this, you know, so we can think of this as a, instead of thinking of it as a 4-component complex vector, let's separate out the first component and the final 3. Okay, so I'll group the final 3 into a 3-vector. Okay, and write it that way. And so now, now I could consider the following map acting on the Octonians. I could take M0 to itself, I leave it alone, but this final 3-component complex vector, I hit it with a 3x3 complex matrix. Where you and what one can check, I won't check this here, but what if this is an element, if the unitary matrix U is an element of SU3, then this is an automorphism. So this is part of the automorphism group. And in particular, this is exactly the set of automorphisms that leave my favorite, my preferred imaginary L unchanged. Okay, so these are the subgroup of G2 is the set of all automorphisms that mix up the elements of the Octonians arbitrarily. But if I ask for the subgroup of automorphisms which leave one particular preferred octonion alone, namely the imaginary L, then that's this subgroup SU3, okay? Okay. So now let's get back to, so how do, what is the corresponding thing for the exceptional Jordan algebra now? So now we'll look, now let's look at a particular element of the exceptional Jordan algebra, H3O. Okay, so we can write it like, so it's a 3x3 Hermitian matrix with octonions. So let's write, on the diagonal we have real numbers because it's Hermitian. So I'll call those zeta 1, zeta 2, and zeta 3. And then off the diagonal, I have octonions. So let me call, I've been writing these in a particular order just to explain what I'm doing. If I look at the second row and the third column, then by cyclic ordering, that 2, 3, the natural name for that object is well, actually, sorry, let me use a different notation here. Let me call that octonion mu1, and then because it's Hermitian down here, I'll have its conjugate. And then by the same reasoning, you know, in the 3, 1 component of the matrix, I would have mu 2, the second octonion, and its conjugate across the diagonal. And finally, I would have mu 3 here and mu 3 bar over here. Okay, so that's my element. But now let me, just like we did a moment ago, let me take my octonion, mu 3, and split it into 4 complex numbers. So I'll write the first complex number, you know, sorry. I didn't mean mu 3. I meant, you know, let's take the, so I have these 3 octonions, mu I, where I is 1, 2, or 3. And I'm going to split each of them as follows. I'm going to take its first component and call that, well, I'll call that capital, I'll call that lowercase m. Okay, so that was like my m0 before. And then again, I'll have a set of three complex numbers in a triple here, MI1, MI2, capital MI1, MI2, and MI3. Or in other words, let me write that as just, so the first complex number, which is alone, is the one that includes the, came from the identity element, I'll call it MI, and then I'll just refer to this other three-component complex vector as capital MI vector. Okay, so then with that notation, I can rewrite this in a new way. When I split each of my mu's, I'll leave the little m, I split it into a little m and a capital M. Let me leave the little m in place. Okay, so the first thing when I split this thing up is I get a new matrix, zeta 1, zeta 2, zeta 3, and then now instead of mu's, I just have little m's everywhere I used to have mu's. And now I still have to take, I now have 3 vectors, capital M1, capital M2, and capital M3, 3 complex vectors that I haven't written down yet. So let me group those guys. It's convenient to group those guys into their own 3x3 matrix whose columns are M1, M2, and M3. Okay. So this guy, so I've just defined this guy. So now so I started with a Hermitian matrix with octonionic elements, and I just split that into a Hermitian matrix with a complex Hermitian matrix, now 3x3 complex Hermitian, and another matrix which is just a general 3x3 complex matrix. Okay, and let me call this guy X, Let me call this guy Y. Okay, so now there is a, if I, so I just found the subgroup SU3, which was the subgroup of the Actonians which preserved my preferred imaginary element L. So now I'm going to consider the same thing, but for the exceptional Jordan algebra. What is the most general? By the way, I realize I completely don't know what time it is. Okay, so yeah, I'm doing okay. So now I want to ask, what is the most general automorphism of the exceptional Jordan algebra, which has exactly that same property? It preserves the splitting of the Actonians into a preferred imaginary, which I'll leave alone, and the rest. So I can, okay. So the answer can be nicely explained in, when we've split the elements up this way, which is that for any X, for this matrix, for this 3x3 complex matrix X, we send it to VXV dagger, where V is any matrix in SU3, any element of SU3. So we do a change of, we do an SU3 change of basis on the X component of the matrix. And then Y, we send that to UXV dagger, where U is another element of SU3. So what's happening here is that, so U is really exactly the same U we had before. U is, if you think about what U is, oh, whoops, sorry, I wrote this wrong. I meant to say that this, so X goes to VXV dagger and Y goes to UYV dagger. Okay, so if you think about this, what's happening is that the matrix V is responsible in both cases for mixing up the three different Actonians, M1, M2, and M3. Okay, so it mixes one Actonian into a completely different Actonian, both over here in the X matrix and over here, because on this side, in the matrix Y, you know, since V is only hitting it from the right, it's mixing up these three columns. It permutes the column components of this matrix, whereas U is only appearing, U only acts on Y, and it's only mixing up the rows. So it's mixing up each column independently here, just like it did, exactly like it did when it was acting on the Actonians alone. Okay, so, and again, one can check that this is an automorphism of H3O. And so if you look at what automorphism is it? Well, it's basically SU3 times SU3, because we can independently choose an element U from SU3 and another element V from SU3. Okay, well, not quite, because we still notice that if we made the transformation, suppose we chose any U and V, but then we made the substitution, suppose we had chosen U and V, but then we made the substitution e to the 2 pi I over 3, you know, we sent U to e to the 2 pi I over 3 times itself, and we sent V to e to the 2 pi I over 3 times itself, then actually that would do nothing to the transformation of X and Y, because the phases that we would have changed the matrix U and V, but the linear transformation that they imply for X and Y wouldn't change, because the phases would just cancel out in the transformation law. So this is our subgroup SU3 times SU3 mod Z3. Okay, that's one of the maximal subgroups of the automorphism group. Okay. So now, what I'm about to do is explain what the other automorphism group of the what the other maximal subgroup of the automorphism group is, that it's spin 9, and then I want to explain how their intersection is the standard model gauge group. And then I want to explain the geometry of that and why that, once you understand what's going on geometrically, it makes it seem more likely that this is not just a coincidence. It's seems to be maybe onto something. Okay, good. So if we write our element psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, mu 1, sorry, I'm just writing my arbitrary element again so we can look at it. So another thing we could do is we could instead of looking at all the automorphisms, all the automorphisms are just all the linear transformations of this of an object like this into another object like this that mix it up arbitrarily as long as they preserve the product in the sense that, you know, the automorphism of the product of two elements is equal to the product of their automorphisms. Product of the automorphism acting on each element separately. Now, we get subgroups by asking for the subgroup of automorphisms, the subgroup of symmetries that satisfy some constraint. They don't allow certain things to mix. So in the previous case, we found our previous subgroup by looking for the subgroup of automorphisms that not only preserve the product in the algebra, but don't ever allow the imaginary octonion L to mix with any of the other imaginary octonions. Now I want to do something different. I want to ask for the subgroup that preserves this splitting. Okay, so I'm gonna just look for the automorphisms that just mix up the bottom two components here, but don't mix any of these lower 2x2. So the 2x2 block at the bottom is a Jordan algebra of its own. And I want the automorphisms that restrict to automorphisms of that lower Jordan algebra, and don't let those components mix with the outside world. Okay, so to see what that is, I remind you of something I mentioned earlier. So Gong had asked a question when I was introducing the Jordan algebra. I was talking about the 3x3. Algebras over K, and in particular the 3x3 octonions. She asked, what about the 2x2 cases? Okay, so in the 2x2 cases, it turns out that there is an isomorphism that the 2x2 Hermitian matrices with elements in K, those turn out to be isomorphic to the Jordan algebra J spin nu plus one, where nu is the dimension of K. So in other words, the algebra of 2x2 complex Hermitian matrices, in that case, complex numbers are two-dimensional as a real algebra, so they are isomorphic to J spin 3. And for the octonions, they are isomorphic to J spin, since in this case nu is 8, because they're an 8-dimensional algebra, they're proportional to nu plus J, they're equivalent to J spin nu plus 1, so that's J spin 9. Okay, so here what we're doing is we're taking our 3x3 octonions and we're looking at the automorphisms that restrict to the 2x2 octonions in the bottom 2x2 block and leave the upper 1-1 component alone. They leave this element fixed. And so that's exactly, so the automorphisms that do that will be the automorphisms of this algebra. So they end up being exactly spin 9. Okay. And so now, fine. So those are my two maximal subgroups. And now I want to explain why it is that when we look at their intersection, it's the standard model gauge. We get the standard model gauge group. Okay. Let's see. I see. I only have a few minutes left. Okay. So, I'll just take 3 or 4 minutes, and explain that point. What happens? We had our previous matrices X. The complex 3x3 Hermitian matrix, and then we had Y, which was the rest of the Octonians arranged into an arbitrary 3x3 complex matrix. And we said that the automorphism that preserved this splitting was that x goes to v, x v dagger, while y goes to, sorry, my handwriting is falling apart as I'm, well, it's never been great. Y goes to u x v dagger. Now, where u and v are arbitrary elements of SU3, okay, but now we want to take the intersection with the group that preserves this splitting. Okay, so it's clear that what we are going to want is, instead of letting V arbitrarily mix up our three Octonians, M1, M2, and M3, we're going to want it to be block diagonal. So instead of being an arbitrary instead of letting it be an arbitrary 3x3 unitary, we're going to write it as a block diagonal 3x3 unitary with an upper element and a lower 2x2 block. So if we write the lower 2x2 block as, you know, so now the upper block and the lower block both have to be unitary, but they don't have to separately have determinant 1. It's only the total 3x3 matrix which has to have determinant 1. So down in the lower block, we have an element of SU2, W, but we also can multiply it by, it's free to have also an arbitrary phase, e to the I alpha, multiplying it. And then since that's a 2x2 matrix, if we want the total matrix to have determinant 1, the total 3x3 matrix to have determinant 1, we have to have e to the minus 2 I alpha up in the upper block here. Okay, and so in short, now instead we have, now any automorphism of this form, any automorphism of this form will also be in the automorphism group spin 9, the other automorphism group, as long as we take V to be this restricted block diagonal form. So if you think about what the intersecting symmetry group is now, well, it's SU3, because U isn't still an arbitrary element of SU3, but then times SU2 times U1, because W is now an arbitrary element of SU2, and e to the I alpha is an arbitrary element of U1. And then it's mod Z6, because, well, just as before, we have the freedom to send both U and V to multiply them by a third root of unity. But also, even if we leave U and V fixed, we still have the freedom to So that would be, if that was all the freedom we had, that would be Z3. But then we also have a Z2. We also have another factor of 2's worth of freedom, because we can, even with keeping V fixed, we can send W to minus W and E to the I alpha to minus E to the, that's supposed to say minus E to the I alpha. And again, if you, any of those transformations leave the transformations of X and Y, the actual automorphisms of the algebra invariant. So we get the standard model gauge group here. And now I'll just briefly say in words something that I'll explain at the beginning of the next time, which is a geometric observation that makes this more interesting, which is that, maybe I'll just write one more thing. So we started with H3O. And we said that has a geometric interpretation. It's a certain two-dimensional octonionic space, the octonionic projective plane. Now, when we took spin 9, that subgroup, well, really, we'll see that turns out, when we restricted this to H2O, well, that guy has a geometric interpretation too, actually. It is nothing but a copy of 9 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space. Exactly the kind of Minkowski space, Minkowski space with 9 space and 1 time dimension. So exactly the kind of Minkowski space that one often meets in a string theory course. So we kind of find this object embedded in OP2, and we look for the subgroup of the automorphisms that restrict, that keep that embedded object fixed. Okay. So, but then H2C is also a copy. When we now intersect that with the group that preserves the octonion imaginary L, that's like preserving a preferred copy of the complex. See that you can embed the complex numbers in the octonions in many different ways, but there's a preferred. But here we choose one and we stick to it. And so that turns out to be like choosing a copy of 3 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space, the one we actually seem to live in, embedded in this space, which is embedded in this space. So it's saying that we start with, in some sense, this very special standout projective plane, the exceptional projective plane, if you want. And then if we fix a copy of 9 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space inside that, and then we fix a copy of 3 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space inside that, and now in the context of its embedding in the exceptional Jordan algebra, we asked, okay, what's the symmetry that preserves those two fixings? What is the residual symmetry left over after we fix those objects? Then that is exactly the symmetry group of the standard model. When you think about it that way, it's really very striking. So anyway, I'll explain this. That was too fast, that last bit. I'll explain that better at the beginning of the next lecture, and then explain as much as I can where that leads to that line of thought. I guess that's it. Sorry for running a few minutes over again.